So welcome back to Human Emotion. This is our very final closing lecture for this course, Psychology 131, An Introduction to Human Emotion. As we've taken a journey in this course through emotion, we've been able to connect to it intimately with our own experiences of emotion in everyday life, and at the same time appreciate just how complex and how mysterious emotion truly is by probing emotion from multiple angles and levels, different theoretical perspectives, and using different tools that scientists try to take to quantify exactly what emotion is. What I'd like to do in our final lecture is to recap exactly where we've been in our journey through the world of human emotion, and where do we go next in this exciting but very young interdisciplinary field. So in our final lecture, we ask ourselves, is this really the end of emotion? In many ways, I think of this course as a platform for the beginning of many years to come, I hope for you, in your own exploration of emotion and for the field of affective science more generally. What we'll be doing today is starting with a summary of where we've gone through this course, taking a time travel journey through all the different lectures and topics that have spanned the realm of human emotion. Then we'll move on to some puzzles of where do we go as a field? What are some of the most pressing and unanswered questions to date? And then we'll conclude with an expert interview from someone who's at the forefront of trying to understand exactly how we take the science of emotion and move it forward into an increasingly digital age of human interaction and communication. So I'll start first with where have we been in this course? So we started this course off by first acknowledging that human emotion is something that can be studied from a wide variety of perspectives and techniques, ranging across a wide variety of fields, as you can see here. And in answering some of the three main course objectives, we've tried to first expose ourselves to all the current and contemporary theories of emotion science today, here at the forefront of the field. We've also really gone through systematically what are all the different methods and tools and ways of thinking about emotions as researchers. And finally, and what I hope you've gained from this course, is an increasing curiosity and excitement in this new discipline, charged even more than you were when you first enrolled in this course, to better understand exactly what is this thing we call human emotion and why it is so important and vital for our survival as a species. Importantly, when we think about the course, we've covered roughly, it's amazing as you can see here, 20 broad topics. And what I want to do is think about as we sort of span through all these topics that we've covered in a relatively brief time, what are some of the most important insights and questions we've gained? So I'll start first here with our very first lecture. So this is when we went through an introduction and overview of what the course was about, and really what we did is start with perhaps the most age-old and puzzling question of what exactly is an emotion. We covered different historical perspectives on this issue, starting with the ancient Greek scholars and then moving through time to some of the most contemporary scientists today, still grappling with what exactly is an emotion and how do we classify it. Do we think of it as a discrete entity or something that we can capture more along a dimensional approach? Then we moved on to really trying to, once we answered the question of what an emotion is, trying to map out systematically the tools that are used both to elicit emotions, so trigger these feelings in people, as well as then once they're triggered, try to measure them in a more quantified, rigorous fashion. So here, we looked at measuring and eliciting emotions. And the question that we really tried to tackle is, how exactly do we measure emotion? So we all can relate to what an emotion is. We've all experienced an emotion, and we can all see emotions and detect them in people around us. But how do we try to capture it in the lab and try to quantify it from a more scientific perspective? Here we went through 8 broad domains of tools that are used to trigger emotions by current scientists in the field. These range from using films to photos to relived emotional memories to dyadic interactions, using music, singing as some of the most powerful tools that make us feel intense feelings, acoustic startle reflex, startle eye blink modulation, and even how with the directed facial action task, simply by moving our face and the muscles in it, we can actually make ourselves feel emotions ranging from happiness to even sadness or disgust. Importantly, once we talked about how we can use these different tools to trigger an emotion, we then went through a multi-method approach to emotion that suggests that in order to quantify emotion response, you need to really pay attention to its unique and elegant components, looking across subjective, behavioral, and physiological response domains, as you saw here, both at the level of the brain or the central nervous system, as well as looking in the autonomic nervous system at peripheral signals like your heart rate changing or your skin temperature increasing. Then we took a brief detour away from perhaps the topic of human emotion to pause for a moment and reflect on the way in which emotions are manifested in the broader animal kingdom. And here we were trying to really get at the question, do different animals like rats, monkeys, dogs, do they have feelings? So although, of course, in human emotion, we found that we can learn a lot about our own feelings by actually studying how unique versus how similar they are with other species near us. And here what we did is looked at the presence or absence of what we think of as human-like emotions, fear, happiness, anger, in animals to help us tackle the question of to what extent are these emotions truly human unique, or what kind of human uniqueness do emotions have really? We looked at this using a wide variety of tools that researchers use, including both, you know, lab and field studies, as you can see here by my colleague Lori Santos. We also realized that perhaps some of our own emotions may not be so uniquely human, but that we can actually see physiological similarity in some of our closest non-human primates across a wide range of emotions, as you can see here, ranging from surprise to even anger. And it suggests that we even share an intricate social bond and a way of connecting emotionally through what's called empathy or empathic accuracy with some of our closest canine friends who seem to have the special ability to pick up on our own emotions and respond to them. We then tried to explore this question of the origins of emotions, or in other words, where exactly did our emotions come from or evolve from in the first place? Are emotions evolutionarily evolved? So here we discuss the extent to which emotions indeed are more evolutionarily evolved versus more socially or culturally constructed. And we began by really covering ground with what's thought to be, you know, the forefather of this perspective of an evolutionary approach to emotion, Darwin, who had these prescient observations in his writings, The Expression of the Emotion in Man and Animals, where he really, you know, had these fascinating insights into observing similar expressions of emotion among, you know, human and other animals, including dogs and cats, and helped us trace our insights into the early emergence of emotions, not only in humans, but across species and on this planet more broadly. Then we tried to probe individual differences in emotion here. So we looked at important sources of cultural variation, potential gender differences between men and women, and even the role of sexual arousal in our emotional lives. So for example, we were really trying to answer this question of do culture, age, gender, sex, do these change our emotional being? Do they change who we are and what kinds of emotions we experience and those that we express to other people? So you might remember this example from one of our earlier lectures where we tried to look at cultural sources of variation emotion and found that it can even shape the way that we, you know, interpret and ascribe emotions to simple pictures like this of cartoon fish, with Americans thinking that the fish in the front is angry and those from a more Chinese background ascribing sadness to the fish in the front. So we find that, you know, culture profoundly shapes the way that we perceive emotions in the world around us. We asked the question on whether or not men and women are really that different emotionally, right? And whether it was possible that they really are from, you know, different emotional planets. And then we asked ourselves, what does sex have, you know, anything to do with emotion, right? Is desire an emotion? And how do men and women differ in their sources of sexual arousal? And what does this tell us about the kinds of bonds they form with others and the kinds of emotions they experience during, you know, contexts of sexual arousal or desire? We then moved on to look at really how do we emit or reveal our emotions to others through our behaviors, through our expressions. One of my favorite topics that we covered here was the topic of laughter. So We all laugh countless times in a given day. And here we looked at what are the different kinds of laughs that people emit. We talked about this concept of a laughter dictionary that's been developed to quantify laughs that differ from what are called hisses to grunts to even cackles, and showing that these different kinds of laughters are actually perceived differently by others. Some kinds of laughs actually make us look more affiliative to others. Men and women differ in the way that they laugh. And we actually looked at different ways that laughter is actually something that can be quite healthy for us, even at a physical health level. So it suggests perhaps that laughter not only helps us navigate our social world, but really can be a remedy to many of our physical ailments. And then on the flip side, we talked about crying. So most of you probably came into this course thinking that crying serves as cathartic function, right? It helps us vent our emotions. But it seems that crying is not good for everyone, right? And that it really varies depending on the context you're crying in, your own emotional background and personality style, and perhaps even your gender. So sometimes crying can help us, but other times it may actually hurt us. And here, if you remember this diagram, we saw how even brief touches to the forearm, beneath a curtain, between two complete strangers, even in the course of a few seconds, can convey a spectrum of wildly distinct emotions, ranging from love and anger to sadness, so that we're able simply to use this powerful modality of touch to let other people know exactly how we're feeling. So expression is really powerful in how we convey emotions to other people and how we signal to ourselves the kinds of emotional states we want to feel and how we want to regulate them. We then moved on to more physiological approaches to emotion, looking at, to an extent, what can we learn about our emotions through our bodily sensations? In other words, is our heart really a window into our feelings? And research suggests, well, yes, it is, that as our emotions change, so does our heart rate. And here we explore different tools and techniques that researchers in the field of psychophysiology use to measure the body's response, and how we've been mapping a profile of what's called emotion specificity within the autonomic nervous system to really try to get at emotions that range from happiness to sadness to fear, and just how we measure these responses using a wide variety of tools and sort of technically how you in the lab apply these tools and quantify the response. Then we got up into the brain and asked ourselves, is the brain something that was once thought solely to be devoted to rational thinking? Also emotional, right? Are there certain parts of our brain or ways that the brain connects to and interacts with other neural systems that actually may give rise to our everyday emotions? We looked at tools like fMRI and EEG to study emotion in the brain, as well as what are thought to be some of the major emotional divisions in the brain, like the limbic system, the striatum, and the neocortex, as well as interconnectivity between these regions. And this is one of the most, you know, cutting-edge cross-disciplinary approaches to emotion today, in a field referred to now as affective neuroscience. We then moved on to the world of self-conscious emotions. In other words, emotions that are really about the self. So these are emotions that emerge later in life and require higher kind of cognitive resources. They're more complex. They require an awareness of the self and how the self situates within a broader social world. And here we looked at emotions ranging from pride to also our guest, you know, appearance here by John Letts, a television writer for both 30 Rock and Saturday Night Live, undergoing one of our standardized embarrassment eliciting tasks in the laboratory, which involves singing along to the Beatles song Twist and Shout. So we learned not only everyday, you know, folk, but also even celebrities experience self-conscious emotions like embarrassment. Now, when we think about emotions, we know that they don't occur in a vacuum. Rarely do we experience emotions by ourselves in our own room. Mostly we experience them around other people, and they're often about other people. So we know that emotions are inherently social, but yet to what extent do we know how emotions help us navigate in a social world? So here, this was our 10th lecture, we really tried to probe this question of to what extent can we think of emotions in a social world? How do they look in live interactions between people, partners, groups? How do they help foster our most important social relationships with friends and romantic partners? And these are some of the questions that we probed in this module, and had special guest lecturers as well, looking at topics like emotions and social interaction from Dr. David DeSteno, as well as the relational context and how it shapes our emotional lives by Dr. Margaret Clark. Now, when we moved through our halfway point in the course, we segued into looking at this question of morality. So here, we really tried to ask the question of what role does emotion play in making us moral creatures, and how can it influence our behavior for the good and for the bad? So we saw definitions of morality by figures like John Haidt, who suggests that morals are an inherent part of what makes us human and underlie our human goodness or our sense of virtuous behavior. But we also saw that emotions can lead us to perform perhaps some of the most nefarious evil acts known to mankind. And so here we had a special guest lecture by Dr. Joshua Buchholz, who helped us also understand the dark side of emotion and morality, looking at emotion among people who are diagnosed with what's called psychopathy. When we moved on to cognition, here we are trying to look at the role of how emotion shapes the way we think. How does it shape our emotional memories? How does it shape attention to the visual world around us, literally causing us to change how we see the world? And might it even influence our unconscious cognitive processes and emotional life, tracing back to early observations by Freud, who suggested that the unconscious life is a really important part of our emotional health, and how recent work by John Barge and colleagues has confirmed this early intuition. We also had a special guest lecture by Dr. Mark Brackett on emotional intelligence. So this idea that we may vary in the extent to which we perceive emotions accurately and regulate our emotions. When we thought about judgment and decision making, what we were really trying to get at is how do emotions shape some of the most important decisions we make in everyday life? And one place that we started looking at is how we make choices about how to spend money. Right? So in other words, does our wallet reflect our feelings? Do emotions shape how much we spend, what we buy, and can money actually buy happiness? And we found that, well, it might, but it depends on how you spend it. And perhaps you ought to be spending it on other people instead of yourself. So here, after looking at, you know, morality, cognition, decision making, we moved on to how we actually can, you know, shift and modify our emotions. So precisely how and when are we able to take the reins over our emotions and shape them to be the kinds of emotional experiences we want? So here we borrowed from, you know, some of the most commonly used and wide-reaching accounts of emotion by James Gross and colleagues when they tried to define emotion regulation as the processes by which individuals influence which emotions they have, when they have them, and how they experience and express their emotions. And one of my fabulous graduate students gave a really interesting guest lecture thinking about how emotion regulation shapes our social relationships and how we can actually leverage our relationships with other people to help us change our emotional experiences. Emotional development. It's interesting we got into this later on in the course because what this is really asking is after talking about all these different facets of emotion, we then got to try to look at how early in our life do emotions actually begin? So can we see emotions like happiness and sadness, fear, even in some of our youngest human infants who come to the lab? And so here we also then, when we thought about infants, we then thought about how do emotions emerge and change through the lifespan. So here we then moved on to adolescence, which is described as a period of all gas and no emotional breaks, right? So it seems that adolescents seem to constantly be on the go and have trouble stopping or inhibiting their emotions. So this has been coined as a period of emotional storm and stress. What happens after adolescence? What happens as we age into our middle and older adulthood? Well, what we found is a very comforting notion that near the end of our lives, we actually seem to become not only wiser, but also happier, based on the well-established work of Dr. Laura Carstensen and colleagues under what they call their socio-emotional selectivity theory. So as we age, we actually become happier and we're better able to harness and control our feelings. Now, if we look at the intersection between how emotion affects health, we explored three broad domains critical to healthy survival. This included looking at the relationship between emotion and sleep, finding that sleep indeed seems to be a form of overnight therapy for our emotional brain, helping restore and sort of put back in balance our emotional well-being. We also looked at the impact of stress, both short-term and long-term, or more chronic stress on our emotional health, finding, not surprisingly, chronic stress to be detrimental to our emotional health, but perhaps short and intermittent bouts of stress actually help us accomplish our most important life goals and tasks. Then we also looked at the role of hormones, right? Delving into the neuroendocrine system, and this is a really up-and-coming area in the field of affective science, and trying to understand, by measuring hormonal levels, can we understand something about our emotions, and exactly what insights can we see, and would this differ for men versus women? And then we got to the topic that is of something most personal interest to me as a clinical psychologist, looking at the role of emotional disorders. In other words, here we ask the question, can emotion go awry? And what we did is cover three broad themes describing the ways in which emotion can become dysregulated, either through extremes, absences, or disjunctions, and how they become dysregulated and impairing in this way. And we looked at this transdiagnostically, so across a wide variety of clinical disorders, ranging from anxiety to depression, mania, schizophrenia, and even personality disorders like borderline personality disorder. And then we turn to try to think about how can we use emotion to promote increased mental health? How can we enhance human well-being? Well, there's the topic of resilience that suggests that most people have this amazing ability to seemingly bounce back, you know, like this beach ball you see here. We're all like these emotional beach balls in many ways that we can bounce back even from some of the most difficult life traumas. And here we also had a fantastic guest lecture from a renowned expert on emotion and psychotherapy telling us how we can sort of translate these insights from a course like this on human emotion to develop more targeted interventions to help people both increase positive emotion and decrease distressing and impairing negative emotions. And we concluded by turning to a topic of fascination to human beings for centuries, which is happiness. And we started by asking exactly what is happiness, how do people define it, and how can we find it in a society with an ever-increasing desire to become happy? Importantly, we also talked about some caveats, and this is the work that I specialize in my laboratory here at Yale, which is looking at the other side of happiness, realizing that happiness, like any state in life, has two sides. There's a good side, an adaptive side, but there may also be a dark side of happiness, talking about the ways in which happiness is experienced too intensely, in the wrong context, or pursued for the wrong reasons, it may actually backfire and decrease our overall sense of well-being. And this is something that if you're interested in learning more about, you can check out my lab, the Positive Emotion and Psychopathology Lab, www.yalepeplab.com. And this is something that we've been pursuing with another scholar in the field, Judith Moskowitz, with a book we have coming out called Seeing Both Sides, The Light and Dark Side of Positive Emotions. So here we try to take a comprehensive approach to happiness and well-being by looking at not only the ways that these states are good for us, but when, where, and how they can actually be too much and be to our emotional disadvantage. So it's coming soon, so stay tuned. We also had a very special guest lecturer from philosopher and cognitive scientist Josh Knobe, who helped us think about how our morality, our sense of good and badness, how that can shape the way we perceive happiness in others and how we ascribe happiness to other people as well. And now here we are, you know, summarizing this course and looking ahead to the future. And I hope that when we think about summarizing this course, it's important to really think about the unique aspects and experiences that this course provided, which really, I would think, are like any other course on human emotion you've seen before. So in addition to covering some of these exciting topics, you've been able to really view these fantastic videotape guest lectures that have been broken up into 20-minute modules. So you've had 3 20-minute modules for each lecture with takeaway questions to help hone some of the most critical insights and points covered in each lecture. You've also had the opportunity to engage in interactive discussions using state-of-the-art online technology to have discussions about some of these topics, some of the controversies behind them, with both myself as the professor as well as some of my graduate student teaching fellows. And finally, perhaps one of the most treasured, unique components of this course is, for the first time ever, this Expert in Emotion interview series that aired especially for this course. So this included a state of art series that conducted interviews with experts in emotion across the entire country. And here you have the opportunity to view live conversations with visionary figures in the field, including those names listed here, who directly mapped onto the exciting research that we talked about in lecture and that you covered in your readings. So this is something that I think, unlike any other course, you were not only able to read about some of these insights in the field of human emotion, but actually be able to literally hear and see the minds behind them. So we covered where we went. Now where do we go from here? So we know that emotion is this exciting and interdisciplinary field. And it's also one that's relatively new. So we've seen recent interest and an explosion of scientific attention only in the past few decades. So in many ways, this leaves more unanswered questions than answered questions and many opportunities for people and students like you to become engaged in this field and move it forward into whole new territories. So what I'll try to do is conclude by highlighting what I think of as some of the perhaps key puzzles. I'll talk about 4 of them. But I want to emphasize that these are just 4 puzzles, and there are likely countless more puzzles out there as we move forward into this brave new world of human emotion. So when we think about some of the puzzles, one of the ones that has come up consistently is trying to link the kinds of emotional experiences that we see in the lab to the real world emotions that unfold around us every day in our own lives. So here, what I think is a critical and important direction to move forward in is to try to translate what we measure in the lab to what we see out there in the world in front of us, and really try to capture the essence of what we all are so familiar with and is so intimate to all of us as the experience of feeling emotion. I think one of the other important puzzle pieces here is to use a multi-method approach. So we've talked about emotion as something that has multiple components, right? It has a subjective response, a behavioral display, physiological features, and the autonomic nervous system in the brain, and also up-and-coming insights in genetics. And more as we move forward, as we measure emotion, it's critical that we integrate these tools and that we try to engage in ever-increasing interdisciplinary collaborations, not only among psychologists with different areas of specialization, but also with neuroscientists, geneticists, sociologists, anthropologists, to really gain the most comprehensive portrait of emotion that we can. And I think for many of us, a lot of early work on emotion, especially in clinical psychology, often focused on identifying patterns of distress and how we can alleviate people's suffering. So how can we make people feel less anxious or less depressed? But there's been an ever-increasing movement now to think about how can we use emotion to better understand and cultivate a good life. So one that is full not only of happiness, but of meaning and promoting compassion. So this is a really important emerging trend in the field to think about not only the ways in which emotions can lead us to suffer, but how we can leverage our emotions and understand them to build the best possible life for us as human beings. And finally, emotion and technology. So we're existing in an ever-increasing technological world. And how can we use some of these, you know, commonly used social media tools, platforms, things like Facebook and Twitter? How do we understand the way in which emotion unfolds in these contexts? And how does it change who we are? How does it change the kinds of emotions we express to other people? So with this topic, it actually helps us segue into our very final expert interview with a renowned expert on this topic and who works at Facebook as the engineering director. So here, our Experts in Emotion interview will be with Arturo Bejar, the director of engineering at Facebook, and he'll be speaking with us on emotion and social media. Arturo, as director of engineering at Facebook, has worked on social tools to help people be more mindful of each other. This includes such areas as identity, harm and abuse prevention, ways to develop better online citizens, and tools designed to help resolve conflicts between individuals, such as bullying. Previously, he worked at Yahoo, where he worked with a global team dedicated to providing a secure online experience. So I now turn to our last Experts in Emotion interview, together with Arturo Bejar, on emotion and social media. Thank you for a wonderful course, and farewell.